Welcome back for our final and exciting module of the day in ASP.NET Identity Jumpstart. We are here to talk about...
I can't tell who you are, not with those glasses on.
I'm going to wear these for the whole rest of the session. I'm going to be driving on the road,
all right,
I'm texting with these. Dark. All right. This is Identity Tips and Recommendations. We're going to talk about some basic things to integrate in your application, things that you might wonder about, email verification, some other things that help round out the features in your application, your identity application. Sound good?
And if you haven't gotten questions answered, go ahead and drop a question in the chat room. We'll try our best to see if those are some things that we have some time to answer. Can't guarantee it, but we'll do our best. So, yeah.
All right, talk about the module overview here. Every time I go off camera on, I'm gonna... recommendations and warning, and then we have lots of little bite-sized demos on here, so little things to see. Recommendations and warnings. When it comes to security, I have some basic recommendations. I actually did about a 5-hour course on security, and the research for it was very interesting, just unveiling how many different issues there were in people's applications and how bad security practices are, and things that people say about security that might not just be true or kind of they think might be an okay practice and it's not. So first thing, SSL everywhere in your application. Secure your application everywhere. And I don't mean just secure your login process. I mean secure your entire application from beginning to end. Why is that? Because, I'll tell you why. My good friends, if you are at a cafe, let's just take that example to start, and you go and you authenticate, and let's say it's over SSL, but then you navigate to a part of that same exact website that's not SSL, what happens? Your cookies still get sent over. And your cookie with that secure encrypted data or hash data or however the provider does it, that is going across the wire too. And it's really, really easy to sniff a network. And when you see that cookie network come across, the cookie come across the network, grab that value. You can actually set it inside of your browser. Some browsers allow you to do it right on the address bar. You can literally type in JavaScript and set a cookie. Some interesting ways of doing that. And then you hijack their session. That's it, just because you stole that one cookie. They may have logged in over SSL, but you stole it when they weren't on SSL. So it's very important to protect your entire application from beginning to end on SSL. Now you say, all right, well, I don't let my users happen to work at, I don't know, their local favorite coffee shop. Maybe this isn't some sort of internal application only. Okay, well, imagine that somebody has hacked into one of your servers somehow, and they've installed some sort of sniffer on your network, and they're looking for any kind of credentials or tokens they can use to get into an important internal application. It happens all the time. So always use SSL. Enforce a strong password policy. So if you want, you can increase the default values on the password validator. The default built-in values on a validator are, let's create this basic website here. We'll call this best practices number one. We're gonna do an MVC app. I can't say it enough times, I love NuGet. The fact that I create a new project, it installs it all, I can upgrade them, it is really cool. All right, let's go to our password validator here. Notice the password validator default length is right there. That is too low in my humble opinion.
Yeah, mine too.
Way too low, 6. These other ones are pretty good. Require a letter, non-letter or digit, great. Require digit, true. All these defaults are good. This is the one here I would definitely increment, required length. At an absolute minimum, 8, if not longer. But 8, you kind of see is a pretty typical one nowadays too. So that is in your identity config, and that's where we configure our manager. We looked at all this code earlier, but this is where we can set basic settings. User validator, password validator. And we're going to get to some of these very shortly. Use CSurf. What is CSurf? I try to surf. I'm not a good surfer. People say, do you surf? You live in Southern California. I say, I attempt to surf. That's about it.
CSurf.
Use CSurf. I surf on the sea. What was the other one? Oh, async, await. Doing a play of words during the break here. So you see CSERF tokens everywhere on your post method. So what is a CSERF token? You'll see them throughout the code here. Do I not have any of this template app here? There we go. Let's go to my account controller. Yeah, this guy right here. Validate anti-forgery token. So if we look at our log off, I think I have a view here. From our login, we log off, and right here is what we're looking for. So the anti-forgery tokens, and there's anti-forgery tokens that exist in web forms and in MVC. What this does is if an attacker happens to be sniffing the network, well, let's rephrase that. Let's say an attacker sees a, maybe grabs something out of your browser. One of the common attacks that you'll see is you might get emailed a link. Anybody ever get one of those bad emails that say, hey, you know, check this out. Even go to Microsoft.com for whatever, and you mouse over it in your email and you realize that it's actually a completely malicious site or some site that you don't know. And so what they can try to do is they can try to trick you into doing things on their behalf. They might even send you a valid link. So for example, let's say your bank has a URL, /account/add user. Maybe you're an administrator at your bank. You are authenticated to your bank already. You already have the cookie in your browser. You have an active session. They send you an email that says, hey, click on this for the best tech books of all time. You click on it, and it's just that URL. /account/add user name=Jeremy. Boom. Depending on how they've written that application, they've just created a user based on your behalf. So the idea that with anti-forgery tokens is there's several pieces of information that are required to be able to make a request. There's actually a token that gets generated on a page. That token gets validated on the server side through an attribute like this guy right here, validate anti-forgery token. And in addition, there's also cookie values that are checked as well. So it's not just something that can do just by URL. There's kind of a couple features of this. Now, these are not one-time tokens. You can replay these requests. So if you have all the data, you technically could replay a request. The idea is you want to try to make this as unique as possible so an attacker can't replay this later. Or like a two-factor authentication, maybe they don't have all the information necessary to make that request. So with anti-forgery tokens, we have a bunch of them in place in the default templates here. I recommend anywhere in your application that you have data that needs to be validated when it comes back to the server, all you need to do is anti-forgery token, and you can see this in the default templates, html.anti-forgery token, and on the server side, validate anti-forgery token on your post methods. So CSERF, cross-site request forgery tokens. That's what you want to, that's why, XSRF.
Is the rule for implementing CSERF always implement CSERF, or does it really kind of depend on what kind of data you have on your website?
I always implement it just as a general practice. When a user's logged into my site, and if I just have like a basic anonymous website that you know people can just maybe fill out, whatever, there's no logins happening, nothing really important like that, user's not logged in, I shy away from it.
Okay.
If a user's logged into the site, I will use them virtually for every single post method.
Okay.
Do not allow for unlimited login attempts. So we'll look at lockouts. And you might think of an account lockout, and you're like, I don't want to do that. I want my users to log in. Don't do it. There are literally bazillions of people, and that's an official number, bazillion, and they press a button on a script that they either have written or downloaded off the net. You may have heard of the term script kiddies. So they'll press a button, and they just start enumerating sites. They find some. They just start trying to do a login attack against it using this password, that password, that password, that password. And let's say you have something like a 6-character password, and you don't implement an account lockout, then they can literally take a password database and they can just start hitting and trying to log in as some user. And it's pretty easy to find out users that exist on a system through a little social engineering. They might call them, or they could find out maybe through a cache at the local cyber cafe. I mean, there's a lot of different ways people can find that users have an account somewhere. Even blogs or forums on the net, you see people that have email accounts there, you know what providers they have. So folks will actually literally just take a password database, they get a couple of usernames, or they try to randomly go through usernames, like Adam Smith, you know, common names like that, and just using a password database. If you have a 6-character password, it's a pretty good chance that over time, if it's not getting locked out, that they might potentially get some of your users' passwords. So we're going to look at how to implement that. If your security requirements demand it, this is a pluggable system. ASP.NET Identity is pluggable. You can actually change your password hashing method. That is not something I would recommend for everybody. That is a specific security scenario. As Jeremy was saying earlier, there are some security experts that recommend doing it longer, but there's a trade-off there, because the longer you do a password hash, the more tax it puts on your system and the longer it takes a user to log in. You know, imagine if you're doing a second of password hashing for every user and you have thousands of users hitting your site all the time. I mean, that's a lot of calculations going on the server. So there's a balance there, and I think what's provided by default is pretty good. Secondly, consider shortening on-validate identity times to expire sessions. So this guy right here, on-validate identity, and we're going to look at what actually this can be used for shortly. So just as a general, this is 30 minutes right now, and we'll look at what changing this does in one of the demos here. Now, here's always been a topic of debate. How do you store your credentials? Now, if you're using web forms currently and you're using really any of the versions for some time back, there's a little known utility that works for the existing versions. This does not work in the new technology coming out, but ASP.NET underscore regiis, you could specify something in your config file and it would encrypt it. So you deploy your app to the server, and let's say you have a section there called connection strings, and you have plain text database credentials there. You could run this on the server that you deployed to, because it uses the local encryption on the system. You don't want to do it on your dev machine and migrate it to the server. It won't understand what's encrypted. It uses local information on the system, your data protection API, to encrypt these settings. So you can call this ASP.NET regiis-pe, E is for encrypt, D is for decrypt, something on the server, and it encrypts it. You don't ever have to worry about decrypting. It happens on the fly. You can use a config source. So in your web config file, you don't have to have all of your settings in there. You can actually point it to another file that has maybe your credentials in there. And there's some pretty good articles out there. I think I have a reference to one at the end on how to keep credentials out of source control. And one of the ways you can do that is by not putting it all in web config, pointing web config to maybe something called like devcredentials.config, and never ever put that file into source control. And note that password expiration is not built in. There's lockout built in. So password expiration it's not right for every system. It's a decent policy. Just consider that option carefully. You could surely write your own actually pretty easily. It's just not supported as it stands in the template that you get right now. But think about that. You store something in the database, last password change time, and you check it when your user logs in. That's all you need to do. So it's actually really easy to implement if you actually want that. And this goes to a question that you asked early on. Somebody was asking in the chat room, identity is not multi-tenant or multi-app. If you want to do that, you can use single sign-on with Azure. And I have a link here to a pretty cool project out there to check that out. And shared across apps via shared SQL DB. So what that means is if you need multiple applications that authenticate against the same data, that's OK. Have them all look at your SQL Server database somewhere else. They will share credentials across those applications. So it's kind of the rudimentary single sign-on, so to say. A lot of organizations do that. They have several applications that share a user table. But that's up to you on your architecture, on how you do that at your organization. But again, I've seen a lot of places that already have an environment like that set up. And it's also extensible. So there's already a package on GitHub that somebody wrote to extend Entity Framework to basically make it multi-tenant. So ASP.NET identity.entityframework.multi-tenant. Check that out on GitHub. That's a great thing about having this extensible system, that people can just plug in wherever. We talked earlier about extending the providers. You know, we saw there's a RavenDB provider. There's a couple for Azure Table Storage. So it's real easy to plug into that system. So definitely, I think if you want to do something, somebody probably already has code out there for it. We talked on this best practice. I just want to touch upon it again. For two-factor authentication, First off, I highly, highly, highly recommend SupportNate for your applications. Users really are starting to demand it a lot. But also, again, be very wary of email as a second factor, because it's not really a true second factor, right?
Yeah, and I would say just consider the responsibility of not implementing two-factor authentication. It's not just a convenience for your users. It is probably a boon to people using your service, and it's also something that just gets all of their passwords, hashed or not, out of your control, so you don't have to be in that equation. You don't want to be in that equation.
Yep. Okay, so I think what we will check out next here, let's do a demo for account lockout, shall we? Let me show you my little, just to make it easier to index this, demo account lockout. Here we go. So I've got that project here, best practices. In our identity config, we already have some stuff set up for lockouts. However, just like some of the other functionality, like two-factor authentication or external login providers, it's not actually active yet. So this here basically says user lockout enabled by default. Well, that might seem a little ambiguous. What that means is that this is enabled for the user. So when that user gets created, that lockout is available. In other words, they're not locked out when you start to create them, but it's available for that particular user. It just so happens that the way that we log users in right now doesn't lock them out on a failed attempt, but we're gonna change that. So that's what that's for. Default lockout time span, that's pretty self-explanatory. Default, it's 5 minutes. Max failed attempt locks, attempts before lockout, 5, if you like doing 10, or 2 if you're really strict. That's how many times the user can fail before their account gets locked out, and then they're locked out for 5 minutes. The problem so far is that our accounts actually don't get locked out. So what we need to do here is look at our account controller, where all of our account stuff happens. And let's check out our login method. And the team has done a pretty good job about commenting stuff in here that basically tells you this doesn't count login failures towards account lockout. To enable password failures to trigger account lockout, change to should lockout is true. That sounds easy enough, doesn't it? Now notice this guy right here. When we sign in account lockout, if that status code that gets returned is locked out, then we just send them to this lockout view. Let's try this in action. Register, I'll do adam@no.com. Okay, easy enough. Now I'm registered, let's log in. I'll just do anything here. 2, 3, 4, 5. There we go. It's automatically happened on the back end. It says we are locked out, and we're gonna go back to our lockout view. This account's been locked out, please try again later. And now the timer's on, so let's look at our data in the database here. That was 5 minutes. So if we look at our ASP.NET users table, all right, lockout end date right there. Is lockout enabled for this user? In other words, will lockout work on this user, yes or no? And the access failed count related to the failed number of logins. And that's it. Now we actually wait.
And that's 5 minutes.
It's 5 minutes, so what do you want to talk about? So you get the idea. That is how you lock out the user. It's a very, very simple demo. Easy to integrate. You just need to enable that when you sign the user. It's literally switching one flag on there.
I think this is a big one. I mean, I think that if a person can't do a bulk attack,
yeah,
you know, what's the right term for that?
Dictionary attack, brute force.
Brute force attack. If somebody can't do a brute force attack, it's just not even possible. Like, instead of taking 3 years, it's going to have to, it's going to take three millennia, and it's just taking it out of the realm of feasibility.
Yeah. Yep. It just so happens, you know, I kind of wonder what the statistics would be on somebody just using the basic, like, common password dictionary, like happy number one or password one, and just try everybody that they can scour off the net one time. I'm sure people have done it. There's so many basic passwords out there. Use secure passwords.
Yeah, like the word password. That's a great one.
Password, yes. Password or the
Are there any facilities to explicitly disallow common passwords? I mean, surely you can do that on your own, but.
I'm sure there's probably a NuGet package out there for it. I'm not familiar with anyone, but there's probably something really easy you can get out there with basic dictionaries. If not, you can roll your own real easy, right? User registers and you check it against your database of, I know you can get common password dictionaries out there on the internet. So if you load that into a table, I'm gonna use your registers, check it against that table, and basically
make sure it's not in there. Yeah,
that password.
Too common of a, yeah, that's a good idea.
All right, next, let's look at doing email verification on an account. So user registers, let's go through that process again here. Let's run this guy. And I'll load up registration. We'll do adam@yes.com. I'm gonna hold off on this data right here, because let's go look at the register method here. Actually, I'm gonna detach from this right now. And let's go into our account controller, again, where basically everything's happening, to our register method. Notice we've got our anti-forgery token here. We are registering. And right now, we're signing in the user. So there's no kind of email confirmation here. But as we saw before, if we just scroll down just a little bit here, for more information, how to enable account confirmation, visit that link. We're gonna look at this right now. And here's the tricky thing that you have to be aware of. First things first, if I uncomment this code, this is going to trigger that class to send an email. Remember our email service and our SMS service? So that's gonna trigger that service. However, what are we actually doing here? If we look at the code here, if we just uncomment that, what are we doing? We're creating the user, and then we're immediately signing them in. We're not saying you need to validate through email. We're actually signing them in right away, and then sending them an email. But they're at this point in time, they're really already validated. They're already logged in, I should say. They already have access to the system because of this guy right here. So we do need to comment that out right there. Now, as of now, they don't know that they're going to get anything. This is just redirecting back to the homepage. So we probably want to change that up a little bit too. And I've got a little, let's close this, and I've got a little demo code. We're gonna change this up ever so slightly. Rather than redirecting them back to the homepage, I'm gonna redirect them back to some other location here. And I just extracted out the message here into a message variable. So the code I'm gonna paste is the exact same here. I just took that, please confirm your account, and extracted out to a variable, this guy right here. All I'm doing with this, and this is just for the demo, there's some cautions around temp data. Because it uses session on the back end, it might not work in certain locations. Like by default, it won't work on Azure, simply because it's using sessions on the back end like that. Because really, you could hop from server to server to server. It's not a really truly stateless environment. So we're just setting this message in here just so I can show it on the next page. Just kind of a little hack, just so we can see what this data contains. I can actually set a breakpoint there. And this guy, this is doing nothing more than saying, hey, there's some data here you need to go check. This is gonna return a view called new account check email. Let's just create that view here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just want to look at one thing here real quick. Oops. Okay. So what we've got here is we're just going to spit out this message here. That's the same thing we're storing in temp data. In other words, it's just our message here to this guy right here. Please confirm your email. So we hop here, we come down, we set that variable, and then we're going to display it on the page. That's all we're doing just for our own purpose here. And then we're going to write this out. So those that's using web forms, all this is saying is we're going to load up an HTML page called new account check email dot cshtml. So we look over to that page here, and I actually made a little error here. This is just, we're passing a string to it, and so we're just writing that string out right here. And let's go ahead and run this. Let's go to my root URL here. Now, I already had that browser open with my credentials in it. I can use that exact same one. This is pretty stateless. I can just register with this guy. All right, there's my message right there. Please confirm your account by clicking that. And there's actually a link. I'm going to copy this out here. Notice it goes to confirm email. I didn't create that. That already exists in your project. Let me copy that out just in case. Ah, you know what I didn't do? I didn't write that out as a raw HTML value. Notice my HTML actually got written out HTML encoded. So an easy way around that, it's a good thing I actually, it's a good thing I copied that URL out. We can actually just do something like that. But I have this URL. So the URL, we can't refresh this page because temp data is a once and gone type thing. That's already cleared out of that variable. There we go. Thank you for confirming your email. Please click here to log in. We are now confirmed. So that was adam@yes.com. There we go. So again, that process is simply when we register a user account. Let's walk through that again so you understand it. We just uncommented the code they had in the basic default template here. Just uncomment that code. I grab it out into a variable so we can write it out to a web page. Meanwhile, you don't have to do that. What happens right here is provided that you actually have an email service set up. This one that we looked at earlier, remember the email service and SMS service? Here is where you would integrate with an email provider, your local email system, or if you want to use one in the cloud, if you don't have one set up, you could use SendGrid as a pretty cool service. So you can plug in your email service there. I would have gotten an email with that link in it. Simple as that. So we generate the code, we email it, and then we just redirect them somewhere. I just happen to send you to a page with a little debug output on there, that's all. So that one is pretty easy to do. Literally, uncomment, but here's the important thing. You must, if there's one thing you take away, you must remember to comment this line right here. You don't want to sign in the user and then tell them they have to confirm by email. They shouldn't be signed in yet, so you have to comment that line out. All right, let's go to our next demo here. Password recovery. All these little micro demos, I like them because they're kind of short and sweet, and they show you some really essential concepts. It might seem like we're working on a lot, but remember, like the last one that we did, I uncommented code and I commented one other line of code. In essence, that's all I did. And then you want to make sure that your emails somehow get out through your email service.
And you just may want to remember that each of these is possible, and then at some point in time, you can come back to MVA and watch the video and go, oh, it's actually the SSL I'm trying to implement now, or now it's the what's this one? Password?
The next one, password recovery.
Password recovery.
Password recovery, yep.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's look at a little password recovery here. Here we go. This one is pretty easy. So if we look at this code in our login page, again, there's functionality there, but it happens to be disabled right now. And by disabled, it means the link's currently not there. So we have to do a little work, just a little bit. So I'm going to delete that and re-enable this link. So I'm going to run this. And notice this is going to forgot password. So let's see what happens here. Run that again, and I will go to login. But oh no, I forgot my password. So right down here, we've now enabled this link, /account/forgot password. There we go, an email link. Now let's look at what this code here actually does. So we need to look under the account controller, our forgot password method. Let's see what that contains. The first thing, we return our default view. We've already filled in our email address. And then when we post it back, we get into this. Again, notice validate anti-forgery token, very important. So here's our data coming in. We find the user. If the user can't be found or their email's not confirmed, we just email them back to forgotten password confirmation. This works. I like to mix this up just a little bit more because there's a couple scenarios I want to talk about here. What if a user never got their initial email? I mean, it happens on occasion. It's rare, but somebody will say, I sent you an email, and it, for whatever reason, the internet gods decided to eat that email, and it didn't come out. So in this case, we need to change this a little bit to make it a little bit friendlier for the user. So what we'll do here is if they happen to come back to the forgot password page, what we'll do is let me stop this. All right, I just pasted some code here, and I'm going to comment out what they had. And let's walk through this. So we load the user up. They've said, I forgot my password. We load the user. If the user is not found, we just simply go right back to the forgot password confirmation. If the user has been found, technically I could say else, meaning they have been found, but we're returning here. So 6 of 1, half dozen of the other. So if we get down here, user has been found. I'm just regenerating their email again and sending it out to them again. That's all. Because I'm assuming if somebody forgot their password, maybe they didn't get the first email, they're coming back again to do this. So I'm just basically sending them that code again and redirect them back to that same forgot password confirmation page. So let's see this in action. And we could actually set a breakpoint here. Real easy for this one. I'm going to scroll down on the login page because I forgot my password. It's been a long week. You ever do that? You ever just
totally blank on one?
Totally blank on something.
Even if it's one that I use quite often, I just go, what?
Like, what?
The worst for me, though, is when I create a new password. Like, I've just changed it, and I think, I'm definitely going to remember that.
Oh, yeah.
And then a few hours later, I have no idea what I changed it to.
You ever use, I'd be kind of curious in the chat room too, do you use any kind of password manager?
I kind of do my own.
Okay.
Yeah.
I use it. There's one called KeePass, KEPASS. And so it's an encrypted database that stores all stuff for you with a phone app and all that. And every now and then I'll register on a site and I'm like, what was my password there? And I'll load up KeePass and I forgot to add it in there. I'm like,
oh. Yeah, and then it's bad.
But most of them are in there. All right, so in this one here, I forgot my password.
I just like to keep mine really short and always use the same one. That way they're really easy to remember.
Jeremy one. That is funny.
Yeah, thanks for sharing my password.
All right, so I'm emailing this link. I'm saying I forgot my password. Here we go. Let's check. Was our user found? Well, yeah, because we got to this point so far. If this looks a little weird, notice we're finding a user. And that, in turn, is a system.data.entity.dynamic-proxies.application-user with all this information on there. This is because of how Entity Framework behind the scenes generates these proxies. So that's what that is right there. That's why you don't see just application user. Nothing wrong with that. That's how it's supposed to be. It's still the same class, still all your same stuff on there. All right, so user was not equal null, meaning we found the user. All right, so generate a token. There's our big, long token right there. That was, again, calls from the user manager, the high-level API we can use to do all sorts of cool stuff for us. We're going to generate a URL with that. So let me F10 over that. And there's our URL right there. Since I'm not going to get this by email, I will copy this URL out. And we're going to press F5. There we go. Please check your email. Well, it didn't go out to me because I don't have email configured here. I'm going to paste this URL in here. Hit enter. Notice there's my user ID there. Reset your password. Very easy. That's all we did. So let's walk through that again. In our login view, we simply uncommented forgot your password. And then in our forgot password, method, once they enter their email address and post back this method, we say, hey, if the user doesn't exist, don't tell them they don't exist, because they can try to enumerate three email addresses in there. You could try adam@wherever.com, and they can try this and that, and they can tell based on the response if they've gotten a hit or not on a valid email. So no matter what, we always want to send the user to the same page, whether they do or don't have an account. That's a generally good security practice there. So in this case, if no user is found, I'm sending them to the forgot password confirmation. If we did find it, we're going to silently send them an email and then also send them to the same page that they would have gotten had they not had an account. All right, that was an easy one. Last demo, let's talk about sign out everywhere. Sign out everywhere is a pretty cool feature. If you make changes to your account, let's say you add a phone number to your account, or maybe you add a third-party provider, or maybe you have a Facebook login and you remove it because somebody's got your Facebook account and they're maybe logging into other services as you. So you go through, you start changing your passwords. In Identity, there's a bunch of fields that you change that automatically trigger your security stamp on the back end to get updated. If you add a phone number, if you add a provider, if you change your password, that security stamp changes. And so by default, what we can look for in our code. All right, when our middleware, remember the startup.auth, when our middleware for our cookie authentication is initializing, we're specifying this method here. On validate identity. And we're saying every 30 minutes, you're gonna take the cookie and you're gonna look at the data in that cookie and go back to the database and make sure this user is still valid. In other words, from a high level view, make sure that the security stamp in the database matches what we have in the cookie. It's a little bit more complicated process than that, but that's essentially what's happening. We do this to find out if any information has changed and we need to basically force that user to sign out. So this is a pretty cool feature. So that way, also another thing is, let's say Jeremy happens to steal my password. And you log in. On your system right there, you have access right now. Well, I can't log you out, I'm stuck. Even if I change my password, your cookie is still valid, right? Because it doesn't hit the database every time. You have a cookie that's set.
It's too late, I already changed your password even.
Right? Well, that might be problematic. So you have a session. How do I ensure that he is eventually kicked off? And that's where this feature comes into play, that if something changes on your account, your security stamp changes. So as of right now, we don't check the database every request because that would be a lot of hit on the database. So this says after 30 minutes, we'll do the check against the database. If you want to make this really small for testing, we could do something like this. We could change this to like 0.2 minutes. So let's... I know what we can do. We'll do 0.3 minutes, compile this, and we're gonna run this here, and we're gonna run it in another browser to simulate some other person that has my credentials that I don't want them to have. So I'm gonna log in. I'm gonna log into both these systems. And I'm going to log in here, same account. Very good. I'm logged in now, both these browsers, as the same user. So this one represents Chrome. We'll say this is the Jeremy with my account that I don't want him to have. And an Internet Explorer here, that's me. So I'm gonna go into my profile here, and I'm going to change my password. Okay, my password's been changed. Let me come over here. Refresh, 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 refresh. So we'll wait a little bit here. And also, let's get a little inventive here. Oh, you know what? I don't have external logins configured here. All right, I do feel that 0.2 minutes has gone by. Let me see what is going on here real quick. It figures, the last demo of the day. It was bound to hit at some point in time, but we've got time, hold on.
Do you want to work on it while I show something else?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, cool. There are a number of questions that folks have asked in the chat room. One of them I want to address, and that was just how do you handle this whole, Adam recommended that you encrypt all of the transport data by always requiring HTTPS for your website, not just on the parts where they log in or provide their credit card, but across the board. And that is a good idea. And so the question is, one of the questions was, how do you do that? How do you implement SSL? And another one was, how do you get it so that they access part of your website with HTTP normally, and then switch over to HTTPS for just the critical part? So I'll address those a little bit. So, first of all, I went out to my favorite hosting service, the one that I use, which is Namecheap. And Namecheap has a special section. So what I'm saying is you could go to your hosting service and see what they mention on yours. I can go right here into SSL certificates, and they'll recommend, not that it really matters, you can use any of them that you want, and there are really a lot of them, but you can go in and you can find, like for instance, I'm gonna just get a basic domain service. I'm really just protecting my domain. I don't have a lot of different, what are called wildcard domains or anything like that. So I'm gonna compare these products, and it's gonna show me a list of these, and they vary from anywhere in US dollars from $9 a year to $100 a year, depending on what the service is. So I can go to one of these, add these, and then you're going to, essentially, you're going to get a certificate that's signed by, in this case, RapidSSL. And if somebody comes to my website and there's a certificate that's signed by me, that means nothing. Of course, I'm going to sign my own certificate. They need a signature from somebody they can trust. And that's what you're buying here is a signature from somebody that the user can trust. And so if you go with RapidSSL and then they trust them, then there's a secure layer that's formed and all of the data is encrypted with this signature on it. And that's the transport. Now, when do you direct the user to HTTP, HTTPS? Really, that's up to you. Whenever you're configuring your links with your website, you can originally, when they come to your website, they just come to HTTP because they just type in mydomain.com. Your browser's going to say, hey, nobody said anything about what port or scheme to use, so I'm going to use HTTP in port 80. And so that's where it's going to go, but you can, as the website developer, you can redirect them to HTTPS, and now they're secure.
Yep.
The browser's going to handle that exchange of the certificate, and they're going to be secure. And if you don't want to yet, then just keep them on HTTP, and then only when they get to the login page, then your link to the login page would be an absolute link to HTTPS as opposed to remaining in the HTTP scheme by just using relative links. I hope that's clear.
And you can take, so if you are using MVC, you can protect your controllers with require HTTPS.
That's require a great SSL. Point.
It's been a long day. on web forms, it takes a little bit more work, and there's a project out there on the net that you can use to essentially switch that up.
Then you know that action is never going to run over port 80.
Yeah. Now, it doesn't completely protect you because it still means that users can, in theory, post credentials to it unprotected. And then when it hits there, it says we're not going to accept it because it's not SSL. So if there's a man in the middle monitoring that information, it's still not 100% secure.
Gotcha.
But it's pretty good. And also, I realized, too, actually, before I go back to my demo, let me talk about one other thing here. With SSL, the other thing you can do, if you're a developer working on your application, check this out in Visual Studio. If you highlight your website, you can just come down here to SSL enabled, and you can enable SSL here, and that installs a local certificate that your system trusts, and then you can just go ahead and test here using SSL. So there's your SSL URL.
Excellent.
Easy. Works easy. Works really easy on your local system.
Yeah. Are you ready with your demo?
I actually realized my demo worked. It's just been a long day, and I've been staring at the screen. So if we switch over to my screen here, you'll notice I kept refreshing this, expecting like to go to a login page. It's not. This is the home page, and you notice I'm not logged in anymore. So we can show that again real quick. I'm logged in here, and I'll log in here. Okay, both of them are logged in. I will refresh, see my name in the upper right-hand corner. And over here, I'll refresh, refresh. I'm gonna change my password here. Change that. All right, now I'm gonna come back to this one. This name should disappear eventually. There we go. As soon as I refresh, it's gone.
Excellent.
So now, granted, I wouldn't do this in production in the sense that I changed it down to 0.2 seconds, I think I did.
Hey, everybody, make sure you go out and fill out that last poll right now. That would be real helpful for us.
Definitely,
thanks.
Please. I changed this down to from a default of 30 minutes to 0.3 minutes. So you have to find a happy medium. 30 might work for you. It just means that if somebody steals somebody's account, they won't get kicked off for 30 minutes. So it's up to you.
Hey, one of these questions is remotely on topic, so I'll ask it now. How would a person, if they're logging in by typing in their email address as the username and then their password, they're logging in with their username, but on that front page, we don't want to say welcome email address. We want to say welcome John. Mm-hmm. So how do we do that? Can you show that real quick?
So on here, let's go ahead back to this guy. So let's go to our application and let's look for hello.
That's there's a quick way to find here. It. There's only one hello in the entire app.
So right now it's just saying user.identity.get username. So
awesome.
There's a couple of built-in methods there, get username and get user ID, which will return you the string.
Can we dot that and see what all is available to us? It's one of the nice things about IntelliJ.
Yes, now the caution here is the get user ID will show up in some places, not others, because it is
right.
An extension method.
Gotcha.
So get user ID.
But we actually have name down there at the bottom as well.
UserIdentity.name, yep. Absolutely. You can actually, you can query this and view, if you want to check out your claims as well, like you can actually just check out user identity and get your claims and kind of experiment and view that. I'll put up a blog post on how to view claims in here a little bit more. I
mean, okay.
We covered so much content today, I don't want to overload everybody with claims.
Sure, sure.
But because it uses claims in the back end, I'll create a little blog post on what the claims are and how you can view them and things
now,
like that.
Now, if I've got a custom application user, would I be able to cast that identity as my application user and then get all of the form, all of the fields?
No, because it's not actually it's not representative of
the full user. It's just an identity.
It's not using iUser. Yeah, if we look at this type of class right here, this is a security principle.iPrinciple.
Okay.
This is not the Entity Framework one. This is something that's essentially built into .NET here.
But you could certainly use the username that you have there, even if it's an email address, use that to look up the user in your system because you have all their profile information in your database.
Sure.
Or you could.
Sure.
And you can find their name. You could even ask them for their preferred name, and then you can say, hello, Johnny, you know, if that's what they want to be called.
You could actually come in here if you wanted to pass in data. I typically like view models, so if I'm passing data to a view, I would say something like, navbar view model, and that would just have like two fields in there, maybe a name, and if I wanted anything else in there, and that class is what I would display down here, and then I would just pass it in for my controller method. So if you look at how we pass information around, that's pretty standard MVC on how you would go from a controller and pass data. In fact, if we look here, I think on our one where we look at manage, that should be a good example. If we go to manage index. Here we're creating a view model. We're just taking some data and we're passing it back to the view. And so then if we go look for that view, so /manage/index, let's go down here and look for manage index. We're saying that it accepts that view model and now it's strongly typed. Of course, anywhere that we want to use that, we can say model dot, oops, And then there's all the values there. So we could just pass in custom data here, the name, and just use it like that as well.
Excellent. That's cool.
All righty.
Another question for you?
Yeah, please.
Do you want to mention anything about ADFS, just kind of positioning Active Directory Federation services to everything that we've talked about in this course?
So I've seen some pretty cool blog posts out there on it, on integrating it. That is a little bit outside of where we kind of covered today on identity. So I would say check out some of the blog posts out there for ADFS.
Okay. Yeah, and you can look that up with just ADFS. You'll find lots of good information on that there. And then finally, there were a couple of questions about, Adam showed a number of different means by which you can authenticate with ASP.NET identity, either with local users or with...
external logins. I know it's been a long day.
It's been a long day, right.
A fun day, but a long day.
Yeah, but what about combining these methods? So could I, for instance, partition my users as they come in based on, these are employees and I want to authenticate them one way and these are external users, so I want to authenticate them a different way.
Absolutely. What you could do in that case is let's assume that internal employees, you're going to require a login and password. And anybody external, just hypothetical, we'll just say we're going to use Facebook, for example. Then they'd have to enter an email address at that point in time. Like, we need some way to differentiate them. So when they enter their email address, you see that on a lot of the Microsoft properties, you enter an email address and then it redirects you then to a login page.
Before you even have a chance to type your password, it steals that and sends you there right now.
We'll see that we have an internal login for our corporate domain accounts, and then there's another login page for our live Microsoft accounts or live accounts. So similar thing, user enters in their email address. If you see that their domain is external, then redirect them to a page that lists the login providers on it. If it's internal, then you just redirect them to a page and ask for the password. Or at that point in time, you could actually do this pretty easily through just JavaScript on the client side. You'd have to include some rules in there, or you call off to a service, some even web API. You could say, is internal user or external user? If it returns true for internal user, show the password dialog. If it returns true for external user, just show the providers, Facebook, Google, Microsoft accounts that you have hidden. So pretty easy.
Excellent. Well, we're out of questions.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. It's been very exciting. This, I think, is a great new system. There's some really neat stuff going on in the ASP.NET space. The identity system I love. It gives us really an easy way to integrate. We saw that we can upgrade packages really easily. We can integrate with things like Facebook and even do a RavenDB backend. We can integrate with Azure single sign-on. I mean, it's really easy.
Very interoperable.
Very interoperable, and you can create all of your own providers. Very extensible. There's tons of demos out there on GitHub on going against different providers and customizing your password hashing and all sorts of crazy stuff. So it's really neat.
I really appreciate you guys engaging throughout the day in the chat room. I had a really good time conversing with people in the chat room and on Twitter. Do know that you can interact with Adam and I going forward by way of Twitter anytime you want. So
recommend it. That's the best way to get in touch with me on Twitter.
Yeah.
Keep an eye out on both of our blogs and our Twitter accounts for some cool stuff to come with identity and some really neat stuff.
Yeah. If you happen to be on the west coast of the U.S., we also tweet about events that are coming up, all kinds of things that happen in our area so that you can come and engage in person.
That's right. Thanks again for joining us.
All right. See you all later.